do support the lifestyle management and clinical case protocol session of the April meeting. Our first speaker is Sean Talbot, PhD, and his topic is going to be physiological quite vigor as determined by biochemical balance and lifestyle interventions. Short bio. Dr. Talbot serves as Chief Science Officer for Life Wondage in Seniors, Master's degree in Exercise Science from UMass, and his PhD in Nutritional Biochemistry from Rutgers. Dr. Talbot is also the lead of the entrepreneurial Master's Program at MIT, and has held executive and research positions in Nabisco, New Street Complex, Zango, Monami, and Wildland. And if you haven't heard enough from him, he's also going to be presenting in the exhibition hall for Lifeline at 5 p.m. So, no more to do, let me introduce Dr. Sean Talbot.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's always great to be the first presentation after lunch when everyone has a nice full belly. So I'm glad that it's freezing cold in here, and we can talk a little bit about psychological vigor. So when I talk about vigor, one of the things that I like to talk about right up front is the fact that when you improve psychological vigor in somebody, it literally is life-changing for that patient or that client. It's not just, I'll give you a definition of vigor in a moment, but it's not just that they feel more energetic or that their depression lifts or that their brain fog goes away. Vigor is a very uniquely kind of motivational energy. It's an actionable kind of a feeling. People feel good enough where they want to get up and do something with that newfound feeling that might have been lost before. There was a talk this morning about psychological burnout, and burnout and vigor are very often described in opposite terms. So if your vigor is low, your burnout is high, and we can measure them in very, very objective, reproducible ways. So here you can see the definition of vigor, a three-tiered sustained mood state characterized by physical energy, mental acuity, and emotional well-being. And it's all of those three things wrapped up together. We can measure depression separately from this. We can measure fatigue separately from this. We can measure mental acuity and confusion separately from this. So vigor really is a holistic way of thinking about how our patients and our clients feel. And when we study vigor, I study it from a nutritional perspective. You know, so sometimes you'll look at vigor or you'll look at burnout, and people will automatically think, well, we need to restore those hormones. We need to give hormone medications. We need to give an antidepressant. We need to give something to help them relax. We need to give some pharmaceutical approach. I'm coming at it from more of a physiological, nutritional approach. And when you study it from that approach, you can see a word cloud like this. My 16-year-old daughter is duly impressed that her dad knows how to make a word cloud on the internet. But what this is, for people who don't know what a word cloud is, the size of the word is indicative of how often it appears in the text. And this text was taken from one of my books, The Secret of Vigor. So you can see when you study vigor from that physiologic, nutritional, biochemical perspective, there's a lot that goes into driving that feeling of vigor in the body from a biochemical perspective. So obviously stress, but primary stress hormone cortisol, inflammation, sleep, oxidation, antioxidants, glucose, etc., etc. So one of the things that I try to describe to my clients, at least, is that biochemistry drives behavior. The reason, one of the main reasons, that we feel a particular way, that we feel energetic or fatigued or happy or sad or whatever the case may be, is because of some aspect of biochemistry in our body. And the reason I think that's important for our clients to understand is that it makes it very concrete what they're feeling. So when they're feeling depressed, or they're feeling fatigued, or they're feeling that they can't concentrate and they can't focus and they can't get things done, it's very empowering to them to know that there's something inside their bodies that can be naturally restored, naturally manipulated, naturally rebalanced to help them feel better again. When we explain this to the people who go through our programs, we see that they're more compliant with their regimens, partly because they're feeling better, but partly because they have this idea of something very concrete that they're changing. It isn't abstract like mood is. It really makes it sort of real to them. So there's a vast, vast scientific literature about the relationship between diet and vigor. And it goes in two directions, obviously. So if we eat more of the Mediterranean diet, our quality of life is higher. If we look at omega-3s, we can see that they're associated with better brain performance, reduced risk of ADD symptoms. It goes the other way, too. If we eat more fast food, if we eat more commercial baked goods, we're going to have higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety and irritability. If we restrict calories too severely, whether you're dieting or whether you're restricting your calories for a weight-oriented sport like lightweight rowing, that can reduce vigor. And in athletes, at least, we know that vigor is very predictive of physical performance. So if an athlete has low vigor, they might as well not even go to the starting line. It's that dramatically a driver of their mental and physical performance. And so this would all be important if we were just trying to help people feel better. That's a win. If we can get people to feel better, that's always a good thing. But it's a bigger idea than that. And you can see the last bullet point here that idea of positive psychological well-being is associated with longer survival. And it's a two-way street. You know, if you're healthier, you're going to feel better. And if you're feeling better, you're going to be healthier. And a lot of work supports that. So I'm not going to run you through all of these different bullet points about the prevalence of chronic stress, which is one of the big predominant things that saps our vigor as a population. But I do want to focus you on the last three bullet points. 65% is the number from the American Psychological Association, 70 to 80% from the World Health Organization and the CDC, and 90% from the American Institute of Stress. Those numbers are referring to the level of chronic stress that's associated with a stress-induced disease. So a depression, an obesity, a diabetes. These are all examples of stress-induced diseases. So 65 to 90% of the population has enough chronic stress that it results in one of those stress-related diseases. And vigor is a way that we can measure that over time. If you do a simple PubMed search on the idea of being out of balance metabolically, some of the things that drive that feeling of vigor, oxidation, cortisol overexposure, inflammation, glucose homeostasis, you can see that there are lots and lots of scientific papers that look at this idea of being out of metabolic balance, leading not just to feelings of low vigor, but actual detrimental health outcomes. But what are those sources of stress? What are those sources of things in the environment that can lead to imbalance, that can lead us to that state of low vigor? Well, there's lots of them. Emotional stress is the kind of stress that a lot of people would think of, bills and traffic and deadlines and family issues, etc. But we also have to think about physical stressors, environmental stressors. Non-optimal diet is a stress, which I alluded to in one of these earlier slides. But I think that we as health professionals need to realize that these sources of stress, these sources of imbalance are all around us. They're internal stressors when we talk about when we talk just about metabolism and the creation of free radicals in our body. They're external when we talk about the environment around us. And if we look at the groups that we've worked with most predominantly, if we look at athletes who are overtrained, if we look at dieters who are restricting their calories to lose weight, if we look at short sleepers, people who get on average 6 hours a night versus 8 hours a night, and if we look at people who are just normally stressed out by their own self-report of psychological stress, what we find is that they share the exact same biochemical disruptions. Cortisols are higher than they need to be, testosterones are lower, inflammatory indexes are higher, oxidation indexes are higher. You almost can't tell just looking at the biochemical scores who's the dieter, who's the overtrained athlete, who's the stressed out person, etc. But when you rebalance that biochemistry, when you get their level of oxidation back down to normal and inflammation and cortisol and all the rest, they feel better. They get the exact same psychological outcomes. We see vigor go up. We see depression go down. We see tension and irritability improve because we're restoring balance in their biochemistry. So when somebody is out of balance, one of the big problems that I see is that there's a knee-jerk reaction in general, maybe not here at A4M, but in general, that if you're off and your mood is the issue, you end up getting prescribed one of these to fix your biochemical imbalance of this, driving this mood issue. If it's your inability to relax, you have tension and irritability and you can't sleep, you might get prescribed one of these. If it's your confusion, if your mental focus isn't there, if you're not able to stay on task, if you have brain fog, you might get prescribed one of these. And you know, there's an epidemic of fatigue or so-called fatigue out there, and lots of us self-medicate with these kinds of solutions, these kinds of medications, if you will. If you add all of that up, if you look at that as a category of low vigor and people using these things or being prescribed these things to treat their feeling of low vigor, low motivation, high burnout, that's a $100 billion category around the, not around the world, in the United States alone. That's a big category of people who clearly don't feel the way they want to feel. There's something a little bit more insidious going on too. When somebody feels that way, when their vigor is low and their burnout is high, they're very likely in a catabolic state. So they're not feeling good, but they're in their future, they have a lot worse things that are gonna happen. They're having tissue destruction in every single tissue in the body. So what I show you here are neurons. On your left, a normal stress, nicely biochemically balanced situation. That would be low cortisol, that would be good level of testosterone, it would be low oxidation, it would be, or at least low oxidative stress, low inflammatory stress, etc. That's a beautiful tissue right there. You don't have to be a neurologist to see that that is a very nice, healthy, high-functioning tissue. Cell. On the right-hand side, you see a high-stress situation. So any of these imbalances, high oxidative stress, high inflammatory stress, high cortisol, high glycation stress, for example, can not just disrupt the function of that tissue, but eventually disrupts the structure of that tissue. So the tissue becomes catabolic, breaks down faster than it's able to build up. And this happens in every single tissue in the body. I show you the neuron because it's a very visual kind of a cell. But it happens in skin, it happens in muscles, it happens in bones, it happens in arteries, it happens in hearts, it happens in every single tissue in the body. When we're out of balance, it's driving us to be in that catabolic situation, except for one tissue becomes anabolic when we're in that situation, and that's our abdominal fat, our visceral fat. Once it's there, the unbalanced biochemical state puts the body in a position where it's more likely to gain belly fat in the first place. So when you're over-oxidized and over-inflamed and have more cortisol, you're more likely to store your fat in your belly region. But once it's there, it almost behaves as a tumor. And so you can see how it's been colorized here in yellow, so it's easier to pick out. That tumor now creates its own oxidizing chemicals and its inflammatory chemicals, and it reactivates cortisol that's been inactivated, so that it's getting a constant signal to store. And diet and exercise can be somewhat effective in getting rid of this, but I think that biochemical balance and helping people restore their vigor is that third leg of the stool if we're addressing this belly fat piece. And it's something that people forget all the time. We've done plenty of studies, and I'll show you some data in just a moment, that shows that when you're able to restore that balance and get someone to feel better, their compliance with the regimen is much higher. Their traction, so to speak, with that healthy diet and exercise regimen is much, 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 much better. They get better results because you've rebalanced their biochemistry. So when we do this, it's very much like a dominoes game. You know, if you manage cortisol levels, but you haven't managed blood sugar levels, you're going to be continually throwing a monkey wrench into what you're trying to do. If you've balanced cortisol levels and blood sugar levels, and you haven't balanced oxidation and inflammation, you're continuously having a cascade effect where your good things, your balancing effects that you're doing downstream, are being screwed up by the upstream biochemistry. So we can look at it like this. These are the big four levers that we try to manipulate in the programs that we do. Oxidation, inflammation, glycation, and allostation, cortisol, testosterone, and that whole axis of stress hormones. And if you rebalance any one of those, vigor can be improved. If you can rebalance more of those, vigor is improved to a higher degree. And if we look up the sort of biochemical chain of events, oxidation, that balance between free radicals and antioxidants, that's about as high up as we can go right now, or at least as high up as my group knows how to go right now. We started with cortisol, then we moved to blood sugar, then we moved to inflammation, now we're at oxidation, and that seems to be the first domino, if you will, in that biochemical chain of events to get somebody to feel higher levels of vigor. So I'm going to share with you some data about how we do that, how we manage oxidation in some fundamentally different ways. And the reason that that's important, I'm not going to go through this slide in any detail, it's been talked about by other speakers, but that idea of oxidative stress, the imbalance between free radicals and antioxidants, affects every tissue, right? We shouldn't be surprised that it also affects mood and energy and motivation and some of these things that go into a discussion of vigor. This is what one of our internal systems of antioxidant vitamins looks like. And what you can see is, I put it up here in this form because it's a very coordinated system. It's not just about the vitamin E or just about the vitamin C. It's all of these. It's the antioxidant network that includes the E family, the C family, the thiols, the flavonoids, the carotenoids, all at small amounts, all working in a coordinated fashion. Unfortunately, people have taken that idea and gone way, way overboard. I am a very staunch advocate of dietary supplements when there's good research. Unfortunately, there's just been a drumbeat of negative studies about antioxidant supplements. And what they all share, we can argue about the details. We can really get into the weeds of the study design and the duration and the type of supplement that was used. But one thing that all of these negative studies do share and can't be argued against anymore is the fact that when you have a high dose, isolated, synthetic type of form of dietary supplements, people tend to not do very well with them. Very, very good studies, long-term studies, large population showing high doses of any of these, vitamin E leading to more prostate cancer, beta carotene leading to more lung cancer. It's just going on and on and on. And so I think the story isn't what you read in a lot of the media, that antioxidants are not good for us, right? We still need them. C and E and a lot of these antioxidants are still essential nutrients. We still need to keep that in mind. But high mega doses of them are not even not protecting us the way we think they are. They're actually causing damage. So the question then becomes, if we're not supposed to do that, if that's causing problems in our body, what do we do? And on my computer, this looked a lot nicer. this is the coordinated system of internal protective antioxidant enzymes. These are the enzymes that our body makes. These are the things like superoxide dismutase, catalase, glutathione, heme oxygenase. There's a long, long list of protective antioxidant enzymes, housekeeping proteins, stress response proteins that our bodies will make when they're exposed to oxidative stress, when they're exposed to inflammatory stress, when they're exposed to anything that affects the viability of that cell. So our body has all the machinery built into it already to protect us from all of these sources of cellular stress. All we need to do is activate it. The problem has been, we didn't know how to activate this system. We didn't know what the switch was until just about 10 or 12 years ago. And now we know that that switch is something called the NRF2 pathway. So this is one way that we're really able to rebalance that oxidative stress idea, maintain cellular homeostasis, and on that foundation, help people to get to the inflammation control, and then the glycation control, and then the cortisol control to improve their vigor. There's a wide range of scientific evidence showing that when you do that, when you activate that NRF2 pathway and you turn on the body's own production of catalase and superoxide dismutase and all the others, that the cells are more protected. And this happens throughout the entire body. It happens in arteries and it happens in brains and it happens in every single tissue that's been looked at so far. So it's a very different way of thinking about protecting us from that oxidative stress. So it's going away from just the exogenous E's and C's and seleniums and beta carotenes and things like that, and really having a focus on these endogenous antioxidants that our body will make if we can just flip that switch. And luckily, we can flip that switch with a lot of different bioactives. We can look at things like turmeric and curcumin. We can look at green tea and the catechins. We can look at broccoli and sulforaphane. We can look at a wide, wide range of natural plant extracts that are known NRF2 activators. And what we're finding is that a big piece of the reason that these foods are healthy for us is because they activate the NRF2 pathway, because they turn on the body's ability to protect itself. So you can think of it as almost like a cellular efficiency, a cellular metabolic tune-up, that when you eat that apple or that onion and you get that quercetin, it's activating that switch. It's allowing the body to protect itself and clean up a lot of that residual damage. It looks like this in cartoon fashion. If you have one of those NRF2 activators, they'll bind to a cell surface receptor. Through the kinases that receptor will activate, you can release the NRF2 protein in that little red dot there from its anchoring protein in the cell. Keep one. I don't know if this pointer is working, but you can see it says keep one and NRF2. That complex is very analogous to having an internal cellular thermostat for cellular stress. Whenever that cell is under any kind of stress, that complex will sense that stress, and the reaction is for keep one to release NRF2. It travels into the nucleus where the DNA is, attaches to that ARE, that antioxidant response element, and that's the signal for the body to start producing these antioxidant enzymes and thus protect the cell at a higher level. When we do this on a systemic basis, we actually feed some of these bioactives to people. We feed a blend of EGCG and catechins and bacopa and curcumin, and we feed that to a human, and we see what happens over time. This study that came out a few years ago shows a very substantial, statistically significant, but also clinically meaningful increase in the body's production of those protective enzymes. So you can see here a 34% increase in superoxide dismutase levels and a 54% increase in catalase levels over 120-day time point. The reason it's 120 days in this particular assay is because we're looking at red blood cells, and red blood cells turn themselves over every 30 to 60 days. So at the end of that 120 days, that whole tissue, the whole tissue of red blood cells has been supplemented for that entire time. So a very, very substantial increase in the shield, so to speak. Those cells have a bigger shield to protect them from the oxidizing environment around us. But does that truly result in a reduction in cellular damage? Well, we can measure over the course of 30 days. Now we can measure something called T-bars. We can measure these aldehydes that are the breakdown product of cell membrane damage. And what you notice first, before any supplementation has happened, and we're looking at the level of T-bars. No, that's not going to work. We look at the level of T-bars, and we look at it graded over the age range. What you see is a very noticeable increase in oxidative damage as we age. And that's very logical. An 80-year-old has a higher level of oxidative damage because they've been on the planet longer. They've been exposed to more sources of things that can damage their cells. But there's also something else going on where that NRF2 pathway is not as efficient as we get old. Our bodies don't make as much of the NRF2 protein in the first place. The NRF2 protein that's there, that NRF2 keep one complex, can get oxidized itself by free radicals inside the cells. And then just our efficiency of activating that system to produce those protective antioxidant enzymes isn't as efficient as we would want it to be. So you can see a very, very clear age-related increase here. What you can also see is when we ask these people, were they using vitamin E or vitamin C before the supplementation period started, and we draw an average line through those supplement users, there's a clear indication that those supplements are either not powerful enough or not effective enough to reduce oxidative damage. In fact, that average line shows a little bit higher level of oxidative damage in those people who are taking something that they think should be protecting them. When we look at the group that took the NRF2 activators, what we see is a very clear reduction in oxidative damage. So much so that when I remove all of the other gobbledygook up there, Now you can't tell an 80-year-old or a 70-year-old from a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old. This is where the idea of antioxidants, and especially this NRF2 pathway and this activation of the body's own production, is sort of an anti-aging kind of an effect. This is where you can point to those kind of data and say, now these 80-year-old cells are biochemically very similar in a lot of ways to a 20-year-old cell. It led the authors to conclude this. After 30 days, remarkably, this age-dependent increase in T-bars was almost completely abolished by this treatment, with an overall average reduction of the oxidative stress marker by 40%. So 40% reduction in oxidative stress in 30 days is a fairly dramatic change. That's something that we don't see in a lot of the antioxidant studies that are out there. So on that foundation, having solved that oxidative stress piece of that dominoes game, so to speak, solved that in a very fundamentally different way, now where can we build to? If that oxidation is the first domino in that chain of events, now what happens to inflammation? Now what happens to hormone levels? Now what happens to psychological vigor and how people are feeling? So we've done a series of studies. I'll show you some data from several of the studies that we've done over the years. These are generally studies that enroll people who are self-identified as being moderately or higher levels of psychological stress, right? So we're starting from a standpoint of people who should be a little bit low in vigor, people who should be a little bit high in oxidative load, people who should be a little over-inflamed, etc. And we follow them for 8 to 12 weeks on a program that we call SENSE: stress management, exercise, nutrition, supplementation, and evaluation. The dietary intervention that we use is very, very simple. We have them use what we call the helping hand. They use their hand as a portion control device. So what we're trying to do is give them a wide range of a balanced intake. It's not low carb, it's not low fat, it's really sort of a little bit of an everything moderate kind of an approach. And what we manipulate each time is the metabolic controllers. The metabolic controllers that we've looked at over the years include what a lot of people here would refer to as adaptogens. Things like uricoma, which is popularly known as Tangata Lee, or Citrus sinensis, which is tangerines, or Camellia sinensis, which is green tea, etc., etc. You can see the whole list there. We've looked at ashwagandha, we've looked at pine bark, we've looked at magnolia bark, we've looked at a wide range of these compounds that are used in traditional Chinese medicine, in Ayurvedic medicine, in ancient Greek medicine. And so one of the things that I love about doing this work is that I can go back to my TCM colleagues who would be studying qi instead of vigor, or my Ayurvedic colleagues who would be studying prana instead of vigor, and I can point to one of these and I can say, you know what? We looked at that herb that you've been using for 3,000 years, and you know what? It works. And I can say that it works because cortisol went down, or oxidative stress went down, or whatever it is. And they'll look at me and they'll go, well, duh, of course it works. We wouldn't be using it for 3,000 years. It wouldn't have survived till today if it didn't have that effect in people. So they would look at it and they would say, well, it's restoring the deficiency of the qi. In the work that we're doing, we can look at it and say, aha, it's lowering oxidative stress, it's increasing catalase, it's lowering cortisol, it's increasing vigor. We can apply these Western techniques to these traditional therapies and actually show how they work. We can tease out that biochemistry to make it a little bit real for health practitioners and scientists. What all of these studies share in terms of the commonality of the results that we get is this. Cortisol to testosterone ratios would generally change about 15 to 20%. So cortisols are going down somewhat, testosterones are coming up somewhat. They're always within what many of us would consider to be normal ranges, but a high normal cortisol is not a good thing. A low normal testosterone is not a good thing. Once we restore the balance there, that's transmitted into real feelings in people. So subjective stress will go down, people will feel better. Global mood state, when we use something like the Profile of Mood States survey, will improve. So these aspects of biochemistry that we're able to manipulate with herbs, with diet, with exercise, with sleep hygiene, with those lifestyle interventions, get people to a point where they feel so much better. A lot of them do go off of their medications. A lot of them do go back to their physicians or their pharmacists and talk about getting to a lower dose of their antidepressant or their sleep drugs or their focus medications, whatever the case may be. And that, to me, as a nutritionist and a physiologist, is a much healthier place for a lot of our clients and patients to be. So, very, very clear correlation between these changes in biochemistry and the changes in psychology. So a 19% reduction in salivary cortisol levels, a 20% reduction in global mood state. So a lower mood state, just for people who aren't familiar with the Profile of Mood State survey, a lower number on that particular parameter means a better overall mood, a better quality of life, and overall well-being. We see this pattern emerging throughout each and every one of these studies. Whether in this we're lowering cortisol, or we're lowering oxidative stress, or we're lowering inflammatory cytokines, whatever the case may be, that biochemistry is driving the behavior. So here with Profile of Mood States, this is one of my favorite ways to measure how our clients and our subjects are feeling, because you can get a lot of data out of a fairly short survey. This is something that you can use clinically. It's a 64 question survey. It takes about 15 minutes to fill out. You can do it electronically, you can do it in paper format, but what you can tease out of this is that, is your intervention actually helping that client feel better? And you can get a lot of data from it. So in this particular study, over the course of these 8 to 12 weeks, tension was going down, fatigue was going down significantly, confusion is down, which means mental acuity is improved, depression is down, anxiety and anger or irritability are down, and vigor is up substantially. Focus on one thing for a second. Look at the fatigue number and look at the depression number. A halving of those detrimental feelings. If somebody can cut their fatigue and cut their depression in half, and you can measure that over the course of about 2 weeks, Profile of Mood States is responsive over about a two-week time course, that's a good thing for your patient. That shows them in a very objective way that, yeah, they are feeling better. So this study we looked at, looking at inflammatory markers in stress subjects, we could show a substantial reduction in CRP. We could see a very, very strong increase in not just testosterone levels or DHEA levels, but when we balance that with what we're seeing on the cortisol side, and we look at a parameter like this, where we're dividing the free androgen index by the 24-hour cortisol, really getting to, is this person in that anabolic state, or are they in a catabolic state? We're seeing dramatic, huge changes, over 400% increase in this, in a parameter like that, showing that these tissues, because now they're in balance biochemically, are in a state where they're going to be able to respond. They're not going to be breaking down faster than they're able to build back up. When we look at the mood state data, we can see that vigor is going up substantially, tension is going down substantially, and we see this over and over and over again. This is a 4-week parameter, so it shows itself very, very quickly. When we look at Uricoma longifolia, this is Tongetali, a very popular herbal supplement right now, we can see a very dramatic, over a short period of time, 8 weeks, drop in salivary cortisol levels, an increase in salivary testosterone levels. When we look at branched-chain amino acids, valine, leucine, isoleucine, sometimes glutamine, we can see the same sort of a pattern. When we can give them at a low level or a high level, we see a substantial reduction in exposure to these stress hormones. If we look at one trial, we looked at the differing effect between Uricoma and Magnolia. We found that in the Magnolia group, cortisols went down. So Magnolia is used as a natural anti-anxiety in a lot of situations. Uricoma is used as a natural stamina enhancer, sometimes for sexual performance, sometimes for sports performance. And we can see that testosterone levels go up substantially in the Uricoma group. But that biochemistry translates itself into the psychology. So in the Magnolia group, we saw that vigor was improved significantly. In the Uricoma group, we saw that tension was improved significantly. And I think where this gets us is to the point where we've been able to tease out that the biochemistry does indeed drive the psychology. And I think it's important because this idea of millions of people having low vigor, I think is proven out by the people who come to see all of us, whether they come to see a nutritionist, they come to see a physician, they come to see anybody who is trying to help them to feel better. It's the number one reason that people are coming to see us. They're coming with the problem of being tired, stressed, and depressed. They have too much fatigue, they have too much depression, they need a solution for it. And I think we've got solutions that step outside of the standard pharmaceutical approaches there. We can use these adaptogens, we can use dietary manipulations, we can use some of the other things that I mentioned before. There's a strong scientific association between these ideas that chronic metabolic imbalances caused by poor diets, caused by too busy schedules, caused by lack of sleep, caused by some of the things that I started off talking about, can really cause that imbalance and lead us to feel not great, lead us to feel low vigor. But when we rebalance that, it's a meaningful change. It's not just, as I showed you, statistically significant. It really is clinically meaningful for these people and meaningful to them in their lives. The magnitude of that effect, that 20% or so change in both vigor and global mood state, is roughly what you would expect from the pharmaceutical treatments. That's what you would expect for antidepressant medications. That's what you would expect for a really intense cognitive behavioral stress management program. And we're able to do it with a very sort of a light intervention with just a few dietary changes and a few herbal manipulations. And so it gets us to the point, I think, where we can restore biochemical balance, and if we do that, we can do a lot of things. We can enhance weight loss because we get a metabolic effect. We can improve dietary compliance. People know what they're supposed to be eating, and they're not, because they don't feel good in their body and their mind, so that they reach for that donut. They reach for that energy drink. They reach for that cupcake. They go through the fast food because they're not feeling as good as they want to. So there's a behavioral effect that we see when people start choosing those better diets because they feel good. And as you might imagine, there's a positive, virtuous cycle. When they do choose that better diet, they feel even better and better and better, and that feeds on itself. And then, of course, we can enhance mood state and vigor, and that's the psychological effect. So this idea of metabolism driving behavior, driving psychology, and it's a two-sided arrow with all of these kinds of things. The better you are at each one of those, the better each of the other ones gets. They strengthen each other, and there's that positive feed-forward cycle. So with that, that's my last slide. I think I have 4 minutes or so left. I don't think we can do questions from here. We can? No questions. Okay. Thank you very much. I'll take questions in the back. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Sean for a very invigorating speech and talk.